shadow of death. The problem is not the actual experienced reality, but the shadow of fear it casts across the mind. And even shadows can be cast only because there is light. The Lord is my shepherd, the psalm begins. We've already considered that the Lord is not a big angry guy or even a big nice guy, but that God is love. And love is not an emotion, but non-otherness, non-separateness. The Lord is beingness without boundary or limit. And that Lord safely leads the way, like a good shepherd, as long as I remain like a lamb, innocent, simple. That's a perfect description of natural meditation, where we abandon our efforts and strategies, stop pushing, and innocently allow ourselves to be pulled by the universal gravitation toward the delicious silence at the core of being, aka the Lord's mercy. Then the settling down of the turbulent mind happens all by itself. He leadeth me beside the still waters. And then we discover that we're not confined to the time-bound, space-bound, mind and body-bound separate self we thought we were. That vessel can't contain us. My cup runneth over. The small self we think we are is like a whirlpool in a river. It never has a solid, separate existence. It's always nothing but river. One day the whirlpool dissolves, but nothing has gone anywhere. No water is lost. No water was harmed in the making of this movie. It has just runneth over into the river. The other little whirlpools say, "Hey, where's Bob? Gee, I'm going to miss that guy." But Bob is not grieving. What was Bob is saying, if anything, "Whee! I'm free-flowing water. Boy, it's great to be out of those tight clothes." It's not that Bob's friends are wrong. Of course, from the point of view of the living, the world of forms, when a form that we love dissolves, we feel desolated. But even in your desolation, you may quietly notice that there's something precious and beautiful about the time of grieving. There's something about it that's a privilege. You get to grieve because you love, because you're a party to non-otherness. For you and the loved one, there's a sense of not to, a sense of I and I. So it's natural to feel that something has been ripped away from you. But with a little quiet attention, it's also natural to notice that because you're non-separate, nothing can be ripped from anything. Your love connection with the one who has dissolved beyond time and space allows you, on some level, to dissolve with them, to follow them into boundlessness. Every time you close your eyes and to some degree melt into simple beingness, you're melting into exactly where and exactly what your loved one is, which is exactly what you are, the one river. You may not even have to close your eyes. On the morning that Maggie died, the email I sent out to our friends was headed, "Now she is everywhere." In 1950, when Sri Ramana Maharshi was dying of cancer, his grieving disciples pleaded with him to heal himself. Calling him Bhagavan, Blessed One, they begged, "Please, Bhagavan, don't leave us, don't go." Ramana replied, "They take this body for Bhagavan and attribute suffering to him. What a pity. They are despondent that Bhagavan is going to leave them and go away. Where can he go? And how?" Downriver. There's one more part of this picture to consider. After a whirlpool dissolves, what if its residual energy, its swirling momentum, persists for a while, unseen, as an invisible subsurface current? Then, somewhere farther downriver, that current takes form as a new whirlpool. Or should we say, it's the old whirlpool in a new form. This old new whirlpool will keep popping up again and again in different forms, to continue its adventures and its evolution over a larger scale than a single lifetime allows. As Nakchung Rinpoche, a lama I used to study with, once explained it, if we're smart enough to recycle our cans and bottles, shouldn't the universe be smart enough to recycle us? The engine that drives our every action is the desire for happiness. The whole universe of phenomena is engaged in the effort, actually is the effort, to perfectly realize its own essence, which is beingness, perfect happiness. Ah! It can do that far more efficiently if it doesn't have to start from scratch with every being every time. And so, it is said, the universe is like a school. You finish your freshman year in June, and then you're not seen on campus for a while. When you come back in September for your sophomore year, are you the same person who left in June? Kind of yes, kind of no. If you have an especially bad year, you can be held back. And if you have an especially good year, you might skip a grade. When finally you learn what the whole thing was about, when you wake up to the infinite okayness that's the essence of the universe in which you've been studying, you're done. You graduate, and you don't have to keep coming back. The Buddha, as he sat meditating through the night in the hours before his final liberation, is supposed to have clearly seen all his previous births, seen how they all led perfectly and inevitably to that moment. Many people have more fragmentary memories of previous go-rounds. You may have had some yourself and not recognized them as such. If this sounds like fantasy land to you, that's fine. If it works that way, it works that way, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. But for some people, especially those who've had a lot of confusion or frustration in this life, it can be helpful to know that it may all be part of a bigger picture. It's like having a bad hair day. Tomorrow will be better. Those who have found themselves completely overwhelmed or baffled by human society may just be relatively new to being human. As they approach the end of this life, rather than think they blew their only chance and feel bitter about what they didn't accomplish, they can just know that they're the new kid in school. They'll be more comfortable next term. We're all on a long, unwinding road. When it runs into a big rock, it may dead end for a while, or even go backward, but only far enough to get around the rock. Each rebirth, we could say, is like a chapter in a long novel, with lots of characters and complex interwoven plot lines. A character who is your enemy in one chapter might disappear for a while, then come back as, say, your best friend or your spouse, whatever it takes to advance the project of unfolding your heart, your recognition of the non-otherness of others. One chapter might be set in the countryside, one in a prison. Some chapters might be filled with ease and romance, some with misery. But when we get to the end of the book, we realize, as the Buddha did that night, that everything was part of the story and happened exactly as it had to happen. Nothing was a mistake. It was a great read. And the moral of the story is to keep opening. The simplest, most direct way to do that is to always be kinder than necessary. And keep meditating, relaxing out of the rigid borders of small selfhood, the body, the thoughts, the emotions, all the life circumstances, and into the big freedom of what you are, the big river of what we all are together. It becomes more and more obviously the open space in which you live every moment, which you are every moment. Then you live in joy, and when it's time for this body to drop away, it's obvious that there's nothing to fear. In a universe of non-otherness, the plunge into the great unknown turns out to be a reunion with yourself. This Way Out. No matter how this lifetime slash chapter of the adventure has gone for you, and no matter whether you suspect there's a next one or not, the traditions generally agree that the end of a chapter, far from being a calamity, is an especially opportune time to open into joy and freedom. In case we haven't already found the space of perfect okayness by the end of life, that blank bit at the bottom of the last page of each chapter gives us a peek at the perfectly pure, white, unspoiled paper that has underlain the whole story all along. As we've seen, our core practice of resting as awareness is a perfect way to just be while dying happens. But for those who feel drawn to them and ready for them, there are also powerful meditative breathing techniques that can help ensure a clean, blissful, expansive exit. You'll most definitely want to practice the drill before the fire, which can come any time but is guaranteed to come sometime. You do have to find out where the fire escape is, and for that you have to go up to the roof. Imagine feel your in-breath to begin at the bottom of your feet and travel all the way up your legs and spine to the inside of the top of your skull. Or, instead of the feet, you can start at the base of the spine, especially if you're sitting cross-legged. Use the ujjayi constriction at the back of the throat and breathe slowly and fully. At the end of the in-breath, remain for a little while, feeling the breath energy still at the inside of the top of the skull, pressing against it. Then, as you breathe out, feel the breath energy bursting through the top of your skull and shooting out like a fountain, going out and out in all directions into endless space. Then start the next in-breath. At first, you may feel more or less identified with the body, and the breath energy may feel like something moving through you and bursting out of you. But after a while, you're more identified with the breath energy moving through the body and through space. Finally, you're just space. The body is something you've left far behind you. You've gone over the rainbow, high above the spinal chimney top, where the troubles of the body and world melt like lemon drops. Actually, you can do this with any breath, any time. You can do it as you're falling asleep, which, as the waking world fades from view, is a lot like dying. But in every moment, you're dying out of the old, being reborn into the new. Just get with it. Breathe with it. It's all good. The Cat in the Hat says, "It is fun to have fun, but you have to know how." My wife, speaking from over the rainbow, way up high, says, "It's all fun, as far as I can tell." By the book. Traditional societies have often had some form of how-to manual that is narrated or sung to the dying person. That is, the acutely dying person. Nakchang Rinpoche was once invited to come to a hospital and give a talk to the staff who worked with dying people. He replied, "And who are these non-dying people I'll be talking to?" Step one is to realize that we're all in this soup together. Step two is to know there are more skillful ways to handle the situation than to rage against the alleged dying of the light. And step three is to know it's a deep privilege to be present at the time of someone's exit and, if appropriate, to help that exit to be graceful. The how-to manuals may be simple or elaborate and may or may not include techniques like our breathing method, but they share the same basic message. Everything's fine. Let go. For people with a strong connection to a particular form of the formless infinite, it may be enough to say something like, "Just melt into the embrace of Jesus." But, in case it's useful, here's one short, secular, culture-neutral version of the manual. If, and only if, you find yourself in a situation where it's medically clear that a loved one is on the way out, and they're receptive to this sort of approach, you can use these words or something like them, and you can ask your loved ones to use it with you when your time comes. Hey. Hi. Insert name here. Please pay attention now. We start with an exclamation and address the person by their first name to catch their attention, which may be preoccupied with assorted bodily earthquakes and psychic fireworks. Now your body is dying. Bang. No fooling around. No euphemisms or evasions. No pleas to keep fighting. No smiley-faced assurances that they'll be out of bed in no time, playing tennis or celebrating on their favorite bar stool. Does that sound brutal? It's not. It's real and it's compassionate. Compassion means feeling together, and it can only arise when, together, we recognize truth and feel its impact. Don't panic. This is normal. This is not a mistake. It happens to everyone. Don't take it personally. Every single being has gone through this door before you or will go through it after you. You're in the right place, and this is the right time. You're perfectly safe. You're done with this lifetime now. Don't worry about unfinished business. You're leaving right on time. When you came into this life, you took on a sense of being a person with a name. That person had a series of adventures, some scary, some wonderful. Sometimes the person felt happy, sometimes sad, but that's all done now, and you can let it go. You've done as much as you could do and learned as much as you could learn. You did a good job. Sometimes you may have doubted that, but you played the role exactly as you could play it. Now you're done with that role. And it's time to let it go, to take off that costume, which was always tight in places. Ah, what a relief. You're not the role. You're not the body. You're not the name. You're not the memories or thoughts. Those things will be going away now, and that's fine. Let them go. They've served their purpose. As you release them, you feel lighter and freer. What a relief. As the body gets closer to finishing its work, it may have moments of discomfort or pain. Don't panic. Don't be caught up in it. It's happening to the body, not to you. Pain is your cue to release the body, let it go, and come out into the free, open space beyond the body. There's nothing to be afraid of. It's like breaking out of a shell. It's perfectly safe. Everyone does it. You're not the body or the senses. You're the free, open awareness that experienced through them for a while. Now they'll be fading away, and that's fine. You don't need them. Awareness remains. Awareness remains. You remain. You are free, open awareness, boundless like the sky, like open space. This is a beautiful and precious time. A time of truth. This is a time of opportunity when you can melt back into what you've been all along, free, open awareness, like open space. This world will be fading away now, right on time, fading like a dream. It just evaporates. You can let it go. Let go of the person you were in the dream. It's easy. As you let that go, you'll wake up into a bigger, freer, more wide-open reality. Don't hold on to any dream. Let it evaporate. What remains is you, free, open, joyous awareness. There's nothing to fear. It's perfectly safe. It's perfect. Let go and just be. Let go and just be. Chapter 39. Love is all around. The Vietnam War was heating up. Civil rights marchers faced tear gas and police dogs. Watts was in flames. And Jackie DeShannon was on the radio singing, "What the World Needs Now is Love." It was a wistful pop waltz with a big string section and a euphonium solo. and in the era of the Stones and the Kinks, it sounded pretty fluffy. But it was hard to argue with the message in 1965, and it's hard today. Imagine that, through some miracle, this song's plea was answered. That, even for 5 minutes, everyone dropped their thoughts about the other guy or group, saw each other through the eyes of love, and wished each other happiness and peace. Imagine that everyone relaxed into timelessness, released their litanies of past injuries and future fears, and, with a cry of relief, flung their old habits of judgment and blame into some festive bonfire. Imagine that they smiled, danced, and took the pain of others to joyously crack open their hearts. Yes, of course, the idea that everyone would do such things is a crazy dream. But I've been doing them, and you've been doing them, and that's two. Just 7 billion to go. We've been calling these practices meditation. Fine. But the more you do them, the more you experience how they soften and melt the edges that make us feel separate. That's called love. And in that crazy dream where everyone joins us, hasn't this love cast out fear, as promised, and cast out rage and worry and craving along with it? In this world, outside the dream, so many people seem desolate, bereft. Perhaps once upon a time they gave and received love in a clear, exhilarating stream, with their beaming parents, with their magic lover, with their beautiful child. But in time, things got complicated. The stream's flow dwindled, or was diverted, or was polluted, or stopped. And now they fear it's gone for good. Some never had it to begin with, and no matter what pleasure or success they attain, they feel shut down, or hollowed out, or bitter. There's been much public psychoanalysis of our seriously broken leader, and the evidence points to a loveless childhood. He could wind up being history's clearest case of personal damage metastasizing into global damage, a big baby crying for attention, crying for love, breaking his toys, breaking the world. But all this sense of loss is based on a definition of love as something that can be lost, a feeling which runs in a stream between two points, two persons, its flow constricted by the rocky banks of circumstances, always in danger of being blocked or drying up. Now, as our view grows clearer, we can see that the stream is in fact a current running through the ocean, water flowing in water. It connected two waves called self and other, I and you, setting them free from their old isolation and limitation. But the current itself is not love. Love is the ocean. Through the current, we found our connection to the ocean and its vast expanse. But the ocean is always there, and we've never been apart from it. We can never be deprived. Yes, of course, when you finally find the lover you were born for, and then in time your lover disappoints you, or leaves you, or dies, it's devastating. I know. I've been through it. But it's not the end of love. We say, my heart is broken, and there's certainly emotional brokenness, but the heart, what you are at the core, and what life is at the core, cannot be broken. That current of personal emotion was always a clue to the love that's wider than any emotion, bigger than any person, the love we melt into when our edges melt, everywhere, oceanic, needing only for us to open ourselves to it. It's the love that is, as Jackie DeShannon sang, no, not just for some, but for everyone, the kind that could make our crazy dream come true. But our experience is our experience. How can it be that people feel fragmented, incomplete, as if torn from something bigger, longing to be whole again, when the sages swear there's nothing but wholeness? whoever or whatever it is that will supposedly restore our wholeness seems to have stood us up. We're standing on the corner, looking at our watch, tapping our foot, saying, "When is the one?" or "the next one?" or "the Messiah?" or "the good dope?" or "the orgasm to end all orgasms, the revelation that will make my head explode, nirvana with extra cheese, when's that gonna show up?" And all this time, say the sages, he, she, it has been waiting for us, right in front of our eyes, and right behind our eyes, waving, whistling, trying to catch our attention. "Hey, over here, in here. When's your date gonna show up? This is the date. This is the moment, wherever you are, whatever's going on, right now." We just have to relax, be open, pay a little attention. The door is everywhere. We can use anything. Feel it in your fingers. For example, right now, please lay your hand on some surface, palm down, a book, a desktop, a sofa cushion, whatever's available. Let's say it's a tabletop. Look away from it, or close your eyes. Notice the sensation, the actual experience of this contact between your hand and the tabletop. Experience it pure, as would a newborn infant, who has no associated concepts or memories. Do you experience two things, the hand and the tabletop? Or one thing, the contact? Go slow. Take your time with these observations. Notice clearly that only contact is experienced. To have any notion of a hand or a tabletop, we would have to rely on concepts and visual memory to interpret the sensation and fill in the picture. Does this sensation of contact have a location? Don't think, experience. No. Location can exist only relative to other experiences, which, right now, from our newborn point of view, are absent. Any notion of location will just be a concept superimposed on the actual experience. Does this sensation have a size? Does it have a time other than now? Does it have a definite boundary? Notice. If you were to make a visual representation of the sensation on a sheet of paper, would you use a fine-tipped pen to draw a clear, crisp outline? Or would you need something like watercolor to make it more nebulous, more like a smooshy, soft-edged mist? Pay attention. Notice. Now, what is this smooshy sensation made of? When we ask that question, concepts or images of nerve endings or tables may arise, but those are just thoughts, not the experience. The sensation itself, the actual experience, consists of nothing but awareness, arising in the form of the sensation. Be sure. See if there's anything else present in the experience besides awareness. Now notice the one that has been experiencing all this. That's simple. It's called I, and by now it's very familiar. It, like the sensation, is nothing but awareness, and its quality is open and empty, like a mirror, boundless and edgeless, like space. And now notice whether there's any distance, any separation, between this I awareness and the sensation awareness. Go slow. There's no separation, is there? So, where before we seemed to have several things in our experience, interacting with one another but separate, tabletop, hand, contact, eye, now we have only one thing, awareness. Are our other experiences like this? Please notice whatever sound is present. Notice whether hearing consists of anything other than awareness, and if there's any separation between the hearing awareness and the eye awareness. Take your time. Now, notice the passing thoughts. Can you find a clear division between one thought and the next, or is it all a smush? Is there any ingredient in this smush of thinking other than awareness? And is there a clear division between that thought awareness and this awareness, I, the experiencer of the thoughts? What have we learned? There is no separation, no fragmentation, no alienation. There is only wholeness, continuity, intimacy. Our old picture of life, in which I'm a little puff of consciousness locked inside a body, forever separate from an outside world of objects and people, struggling through sporadic connections and fragile feelings to bridge an unbridgeable gap, that picture is purely a product of thought. Our actual experience is that there's only awareness aware of awareness, spacious awareness aware of itself. There's no gap to bridge, no separation possible. It's one smoosh, and that smoosh is love. Again, in the words of Rupert Spira, who taught me to explore in this way, love is not a feeling. It's lack of an other, of otherness. If you didn't get this exploration, please come back to it soon, and repeat it till you do. This is too important to miss. In fact, this stupid simple experiment of our hand on the tabletop opens up the possibility that our crazy dream could come true. It shows us that Jackie DeShannon was half wrong. Love is not a thing that there's just too little of. It's the only thing there is. God, for lack of a better word, that which is everywhere, everything, the infinite arising as every bit of the finite, the ocean arising as every wave and current, is love. Consider the wisdom of Love is All Around by the Troggs, another fluffy, beautiful pop song of the 60s. Later featured in virtually every romantic comedy starring Hugh Grant. The song speaks of feeling love in your fingers and in your toes, feeling it in the wind, feeling it grow, till ultimately you feel it in everything, all around you, all the time. In the light of our exploration, this silly lyric turns out to be literal, profound, life-revolutionizing truth. Every single contact you make with the world through your fingers or your toes, or your ears, or your nose, or anything else, is love, actually. In every moment of clear, simple experience, unmediated by thought, the dualistic concepts of you and world melt into the non-dual smoosh. And so the feeling grows. More precisely, our recognition of this wholeness, this love, grows. Every so-called thing, every so-called person that we experience is non-separate from so-called us, the experiencing awareness. There's never two of us here. What remains is spacious, edgeless, undivided. Take this exploration into your daily life and keep corroborating it. Love is all around. The contact of your bottom with the airplane seat, the contact of your hearing with the engine roar, the contact of your skin with the too hot or too cold or just right temperature of the cabin air. Improbably enough, crazily enough, it's all love, all God kissing God. It has only taken us a few minutes to arrive at this insight, but now we have a lifetime to confirm it at every step, to take it wider and get it clearer. It's everywhere you go. God to Earth. Of course, even as we say this, our lifelong ingrained habit of equating love with the fragile emotion between individuals rears its head, raising objections. But I like personal love. I love personal love. Well, yeah, me too. But no problem. Oceanic God love doesn't negate anything. It affirms everything, and it certainly affirms every kind of love current. Love for your partner, your children, your family, your friends, your teachers, your planet, with all its human and non-human beings. This is how we bring God love to the earth plane. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. The nice thing about boundlessness is that there's always plenty of it to go around. It pervades everything and elevates everything. You open to oceanic love, and then, more and more, marriage, friendship, signaling your turns, ordering your breakfast, and everything else becomes great, big, loving, oceanic fun. Taking out the garbage, whee! And more love means less fear. People sometimes imagine that moving through this world with an open heart will make them delicate, weak, vulnerable to being hurt. But in fact, this love makes you strong beyond strong. Look at the Dalai Lama. Look at Gandhi and Dr. King and Nelson Mandela. Do you think Jesus and the Buddha were dainty snowflakes? This love has been trying to come through you all along. Just stop holding it back. How do you grow your hair out? Just stop cutting it. You start to get a knack, a subtle feel for how to let this love wash through all your actions in the world. As you complain to or thank the customer service rep, as you ride home from the airport, chatty or silent with the cabbie, as you hug your parent or child for the 1,000th first time, as you mingle bodies with your partner for the 1,000th first time, in the timeless freshness of the exploded moment, every time is the first time. In the tarot deck, this process of channeling higher love through earthly life is depicted in The Card of the Lovers, shown on my website. The Adam and Eve figures represent every couple, but also every I and you, every self and other, in every interaction, including passing each other anonymously on a crowded city sidewalk. They stand upon the horizontal plane of the earth, the finite, relational plane, but their connection is through a third point, the apex of a triangle. This is the infinite, represented by the angel of the Lord and a solar disk. The angel embodies non-otherness. It's androgynous, incorporating both male and female, lover and beloved, I and you. The solar disk is empty, with light beams radiating from it, the space-like, formless emptiness of the infinite from which all our forms radiate, and to which, following the beams back upward, we return every time we melt out of separateness. It's when we're exiled from the garden, removed from the angel's presence, that our fear and our sorrow begin. Fortunately, no one has exiled us but us. We've got to get ourselves back to the garden, and now we know how. Just reach out, touch anything or anyone, and let yourself melt. As you begin to consciously cooperate with this process, you'll probably notice sticking points, places of resistance, which are places of opportunity for opening. The most dramatic of these are often in marriage. You always hurt the one you love, says another pop classic, reaching back to the 40s now. That's because the one you love threatens the separateness of the little self that you thought you were. You and the other are always on the brink of melting into the not two, the I and I. This, I think, is the deep reason why husbands abuse wives. This is the reason for cruel sarcasm and for the proverbial postcoital cigarette. After the intense melting of sex, we feel we need some way to retreat to the private, separate realm, to rematerialize ourselves. If I can feel this smoke in my lungs or this sarcastic edge in my voice, I must be a separate person. Whew! Saved again. I'm speaking more to men now. Women are generally more clued in. Note that in the picture, the man looks straight across to the woman, and she looks up to the angel. This is a wiring diagram of marriage as a spiritual path. Woman intuitively knows to surrender to the big it. Man, if he's smart, surrenders to woman, and through her, to it. If you let yourself fully love her, you fall in love. Whoopsie-daisy! You tumble out of your phallic tower of ego and go plunging into the sea of love, where every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you, says Walt Whitman. Then you're really in the soup. So, fear tells you, you need a way to stay separate, tucked neatly into your outer form and your well-practiced roles. Whether you make her an object of abuse or an object of worship, you've made her an object, so you're off the hook. But if you drop both concepts, drop the fear that feeds them, follow her lead, look up to the angel, and dissolve together, that's much less work and much more fun. If we dare to use it this way, our love is a power tool for setting us free from the limiting small self, the persona behind which we've been hiding. Love, says James Baldwin, takes off masks that we fear we cannot live without and know we cannot live within. The depths of philosophy, the heights of religion, the so-called mysteries of the East, this is what it comes down to. Your hand on the table, your foot on the earth, one big smoosh. Every contact is a kiss. You, awareness, kissing the earth, awareness, with each step, awareness. You, kissing the sky with each thought, God kissing world, love loving love, written on the wind, everywhere you go. In this, what is there to fear? Where is room for worry or craving or rage? And when their traces arise, see that that also is a kiss. Don't be afraid of fear. Don't be enraged at rage. Don't worry about worry. All is well. Do what you need to do. Feed the cat, teach the child, put out the fire, do the job, pay the rent. But in all this, find the kiss. And then with each look, each listen, each touch, each thought, you kiss what's there and it kisses back. At last you'll see that that's all it's ever done. Sometimes this will all be clear, obvious, simple, delighting. Sometimes, maybe now, it will sound foolish, obscure, impossible. But the glimpses were not wrong. Stay encouraged. Stay in courage. Stay for the encore. Stay in your core, where the kiss always is, and dare to bring it to the waiting world. Every moment kisses you. Everything kisses everything. All is well. Fear not. In all this, find the kiss. In all this, find the kiss. And so, together, we've explored many practices and insights. I've made many outrageous claims. The best way you can improve your life is to sit down and do nothing. Right. We're ending with the most outrageous claim of all, that the God, for lack of a better word, that you sought in your pain, the love that will cast out your fear and all the distortions of life arising from it, is right here, at your fingertips, needing only a little attention to begin its healing work. Fortunately, I'm not the first one to tell these cockeyed tales. The sages have told them forever, and sometimes people have listened. If you've tried even a fraction of the practices I've suggested, if you've seen even the dim outlines of the view I've tried to convey, then you've had glimpses of the great clearing that awaits you. Whatever else happens after you finish this book, please don't forget those glimpses. Then, sooner or later, you'll follow this short path to its end. Out of habit and inertia, you may go back to pain, but you can't unsee those glimpses, and you won't go back for long. You can drop your fear and your sorrow any time. It's easy, I swear. You've been listening to Fear Less by Dean Slyter, narrated by Dean Slyter. If you've enjoyed this audiobook, please visit gildenmedia.com, where you'll find a wide selection of our unabridged titles. Thank you for being a Gildan Audio listener.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.